It's Andrew. I think I forgot to introduce myself before. Brendan McLaughlin, I'm one of the ministers here, the only minister here this week. Steve is on holidays until, I think, midweek. So we look forward to having him back. Now, last year when I was on holidays, I read a book called Good to Great by a guy called Jim Collins. Got these song words on my mind. Jim Collins. Now, I think I've mentioned this book before. It's a management book. And what it does is it's looked at about a dozen companies that went from mediocrity to stardom, and it analyzes what those companies had in common so that others, even like including churches, can learn from them. And there's some fascinating things that they found. Some of the things they found were that all the good to great companies had a CEO who was humble. All the good to great companies built for themselves a management team that was full of free thinkers as opposed to yes men. All the good to great companies were never going on about launching the latest initiative with a big fanfare. They just got on with the job. But the characteristic that really intrigued me the most, well, apart from the first one, finding a humble rector, good luck with that. But the characteristic that intrigued me the most for our church is that all the good to great companies stuck to what they were good at. Right? They never diversified. They figured out what are we good at as a company and let's focus on that. And it got me to thinking, firstly, it makes sense, doesn't it? Focusing on something you do well. But it got me to thinking, crossing that over to a church, right? Is there one thing that we could say that Christians should be focusing our attention on? In particular, one thing that would help us as a church grow, both upwardly and outwardly. Now, the big danger for this question for a church is if we try to reduce the Christian life down to just one thing, we might actually end up missing some important stuff out. Right? So I'm aware that that's a danger. But with that danger in mind, I posed the question to parish council a few months ago. I said, do you think we could, and if we could, reduce the Christian life down to one thing, what would it be? And one of the parish councillors came back and said, look, if we could reduce the Christian life down to one thing, it would have to be love. It would have to be love. Jesus' two great commandments, all right, that sum up all the law and the prophets are, love the Lord your God and love your neighbour as yourself. And the Apostle Paul says at the end of 1 Corinthians 13, and now these three remain, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. Now, look, my sneaking suspicion is there is more to Christian life than just one thing. Okay, we can't reduce it down to just one thing. But when the Apostle Paul tried to reduce the Christian life down to its simplest, faith, hope, and love, he put love at the top. It is important. And that's what we're looking at today, the greatest of all Christian traits, love. Now, in keeping with our series on the fruit of the Spirit, what we're going to be focusing on today is horizontal love, so loving our neighbour as opposed to vertical love, loving God. But, as with all the fruit of the Spirit, our love for our neighbour actually flows from our love of God or from His love of us. In a sense, Jesus' two great commandments are actually basically one commandment in two parts. They're intimately related. Now, if you've got your sermon outline in front of you, it's going to show that we're going to do three things today. We're going to begin by outlining a definition of love. That's from 1 John chapter 4. Following that, we're going to look at some practical examples of love from 1 Corinthians 13. And we're going to conclude by looking at how we, as sinful, selfish creatures, can actually start showing the kind of love God wants us to show. Now, it's very difficult to cover everything in a 20-minute sermon, so I thought what we'd do is we'd have a question time afterwards, since last week's question time went so well. But if you have any questions throughout, please write them down, and I'll do my best, as I always try and do. But let's begin. Now, before we can look at how to love, we need to first figure out what is this thing called love. And this question is fraught with dangers, particularly today, because, look, there's so many different ideas about what love is. I mean, we've got a whole bunch of song titles before giving our different ideas. Love is a battlefield, for example. Now, according to Hollywood, love is finding that one special person that the universe has destined you to be with and living happily ever after with them. At the beginning of the movie Frozen, I don't know if you've seen that with your kids, Princess Anna sings a whole song about this kind of love, about finding that one person you just connect with. That night she meets the handsome Prince Hans, and then literally an hour later, they're engaged. All right? But the craziness doesn't stop there, because you see, when Princess Anna accidentally gets her heart frozen by her sister Elsa, she's told the only way to thaw her heart and stop her from freezing solid is an act of true love. All right? So the race is on to get Princess Anna back to Prince Hans, who's been their fiancé for a whole 2 hours now, so that he can give her love's true kiss. All right? The act of true love. Friends, that cannot be further from the Bible's definition of love. If you've got 1 John 4 there, you can. If you only want one passage open, I suggest you keep 1 Corinthians 13 open. 1 John 4, verse 10 says this. This is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. So love, according to the Bible, firstly, it originates in God. Right? He loved us. But the way he loved us was by sending his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Now, as long-term Christians, we've all heard this before, and we go, oh, yes, yes, I've heard about this, Brennan. We know about that kind of love. But my experience is that we Christians don't actually appreciate the full extent of that love. Let me explain what I mean. In his book, Desiring God, John Piper points out that showing contempt for an authority, right? So rebelling against an authority is proportionally more or less heinous a crime depending on what obligation we have to that authority. So for example, disobeying the lollipop man in our car should result in less punishment than, say, resisting arrest, because we are less obliged to obey the lollipop man than we are the police officer. Resisting arrest should result in less punishment than, say, high treason against our government, because we are more obliged to obey the government than we are a policeman. Treason is a much more heinous crime than resisting arrest. Now, the thing about God, right, is that as his creatures, I mean, he created us, we are under infinite obligation to obey him. Okay? Since he made us, he has infinite authority over us. And so sin, rebelling against God, is a violation of infinite obligation. That's what we do when we sin. We are violating infinite obligation. And as such, that should result in infinite punishment. I mean, that's what hell is. It is punishment for violating infinite obligation. But we're told in 1 John that God loves us so much that he sent Jesus to take that infinite punishment for us. You see, the cross is not just physical suffering for 3 hours. It is hours of God pouring out infinite punishment on Jesus. Infinite punishment. That's love. Taking infinite punishment on our behalf. Towards the end of the movie Frozen, Princess Anna actually confesses to Olaf that she doesn't know what love is. She thought she did, but she's now realized that her Hollywood definition of love, completely wrong. Now Olaf, this is her little snowman companion, says, that's all right. I know what love is. He says this. He says, love is putting the needs of the other ahead of your own. Now, I nearly fell off my chair when I heard that from a Hollywood movie, because that is right out of the Bible. Love is putting the needs of others ahead of your own. And that's what Jesus did on the cross. He put our need Right? What was our need? To be forgiven of our violation of infinite obligation ahead of his need. And his need was avoiding infinite punishment. But he put our needs ahead of his. Friends, if we are to cultivate the spiritual fruit of love, that's how we do it. We put our needs second to theirs. We put the needs of others ahead of our own. So, with this definition in hand, let's now look at what this love looks like in practice. 1 Corinthians 13, the Apostle Paul famously gives us a whole list of ways we can love others. Now, the reason I say famously is because this passage is read at most weddings, isn't it? I swear that this was actually read at our wedding, but my wife tells me it was Ephesians 3. She's probably right. Now, it's a long list, okay? We can't spend an enormous amount of time on each. We're just going to skim through it. But what we're going to see is each of these items is a wonderful example of other person-centeredness. And we start in verse 4. It says, love is patience. Now, we looked at patience last week through the Spirit. Patience is, remember, putting the feelings, the well-being, the timetable of others ahead of our own. So even if your spouse makes you late for church, which is the most heinous of crimes, we can deal with it, all right? Because, well, their timetable is more important than mine. That's patience. Next, we see that love is kind, still in verse 4. Now, the dictionary defines kindness as being considerate or helpful. Being considerate or helpful. It's basically doing things that the other person appreciates. Yet there are some times that we're tempted to do those things only so that we will get something in return. See, if I'm nice to them in this way, then hopefully they will be nice to me in return in that way. The problem with that is that, well, who are we actually being kind to then? Them or us? Manipulating the situation so that you will get something in return is what verse 5 calls being self-seeking. Which love is not. It is not self-seeking. Next, we're told that love does not envy. Envy is defined as seeing another's quality, or seeing another's achievement, or seeing another's possession, and either desiring it for yourself or wishing the other lacked it. So envy is about comparing yourself. All right? It's putting your needs ahead of theirs, because you want to be better than them, superior to them, and you actually want misfortune to befall them so that you can be above them in your own eyes. That ain't love. Following this, love does not boast and is not proud. Now remember, pride is thinking about yourself all the time. And you can do this either positively or negatively. You see, the person who is always thinking about how they're not good at things is just as bad as the person who is constantly thinking about how awesome they are. Both are pride. Both are thinking about yourself. Love is thinking about the other. This brings us to verse 5. Verse 5 begins with, love does not dishonor others, or in the old NIV, is not rude. Offending someone is the opposite of love, of putting their needs ahead of yours, isn't it? Don't be rude. Don't offend. Don't dishonor, ever. Next, self-seeking. We've already looked at that. Love is not easily angered. Now, there is such a thing as righteous anger, right? But righteous anger is usually well-directed, and it's usually in response to some sort of injustice. The kind of anger we are to avoid is when we don't get our way. Right? That's what Paul's talking about here. He's not easily angered. Next, love keeps no record of wrongs. Bringing up past wrongs does very little beyond making the other person feel bad. That's putting ourselves first, isn't it? And that's not love. The list goes on. Verse 7, love always protects. Now, protecting is obvious, isn't it? It's putting the well-being of them ahead of your own well-being. love trusts. To trust someone is to make yourself vulnerable. All right? To say, I don't trust you with this person, or I don't trust you with this thing, that's putting your needs first. Trust puts their needs first. Hope. Hope means you anticipate a positive outcome. All right? And it's particularly with your relationship. Okay, sitting there and thinking to yourself things like, oh, look, this marriage is just too hard. This relationship, we're just doomed to fail. That's not love. Right? We need to be positive. Love always hopes for the future. And finally, love perseveres. Even if it does feel like you are doomed to fail, you need to make sure you do everything possible to ensure that it wasn't you that made it fail. You persevere. That's Christian love, putting the needs of others ahead of your own. Now, look, some of these things we can do. Some of the time. We find it very easy, for example, to love those that are dear to us, that are near to us, that are close to us. And it's even easier to be nice to someone who's just been nice to you. All right, I am probably the most loving to my wife straight after she's done something really loving for me. But here's the thing. So are non-Christians. Non-Christians are great at loving those that they love and that are being nice to those who are being nice to them. So when we love our loved ones, we are being no different to pagans. That is not the kind of love that Jesus calls us to. Or should I say, not the only kind of love he calls us to. You see, what makes Christian love different is it reflects Christ's love. And what does Christ's love look like? Well, we saw before, okay, Christ put our needs ahead of his, even to the point of taking infinite punishment. But Romans chapter 5 adds another dimension to this. Don't bother looking up. I'm going to read one verse for you. Romans 5:8 says this. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. Right? He's demonstrating his love. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. See, what Romans 5 says is that Christ died for his enemies. Christ died for the very people who put the nails in his hands and feet. Christ died for the very people who stood there mocking him as he was dying. Or in other words, Christ died for you and me. As the song goes, it was my sin that held him there. It was my voice calling out among the scoffers. Christian love is shown for those who aren't loving us. Jesus died for his enemies. Right, that's Christian love. He's showing for those who aren't dear to us. And that's really hard. We struggle to do this, don't we? We struggle to love those that we're not feeling the love from. I mean, I find it really hard to put my wife's needs ahead of mine when I got the getting the feeling that she's not loving me and caring for me and my needs at all. And she's my wife. I'm sure I'm not alone in that. Now, why is this? Why do we struggle to put the needs of others before our own? Because we're focusing on our own needs, aren't we? That's the opposite of love. It's selfishness. And we do have needs. Right? I'm not denying that. We need oxygen, don't we? We need food and water. We need rest and sleep. We need a day off a week. We need holidays each year or things start to go wrong. And so when our needs, our real needs, are not being met by others, we feel that, well, if they're not looking after me, I need to look after me. And you look after yourself before you look after the needs of others. Yet that's not Christian love. That's not what Jesus did. Jesus always put the needs of others ahead of his own, no matter what those needs were. I'm going to read to you a couple of verses from Mark 6. You don't need to look it up. Just listen. This is Mark 6:31. Says this, then, because so many people were coming and going that they did not even have a chance to eat, he's talking about him and his disciples, Jesus said to them, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. So this is Jesus ensuring that his disciples and his needs are met. They need food. They're famished. They need rest. They're exhausted, all right? But we read this. Verse 33, but many who saw them leaving recognized them, and they ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. So when Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. Now, look, how many of us have felt like this before? Right? Exhausted, famished, struggling to keep our eyes open, fatigue setting in. Right, you've just got home after a long, hard day at work. You're exhausted. Or you've been up all night with some, you know, a screaming, crying child. You've had like 1.5 hours sleep. You're dead to the world. We've all felt like this. But then you find that someone needs something from you or wants something from you. What do you do? Or what did Jesus do? He saw that the crowds were like a sheep without a shepherd, and he taught them. He put the crowd's needs ahead of his own. And that's Christian love. But let's face it, that example pales into insignificance compared to the cross, where Jesus saw our need and paid for it with infinite punishment. The cross is where we see the ultimate act of Christian love. That is what we are to follow, where Christ died even for his enemies. Now, friends, that is step one towards showing Christian love. All right? You look to the ultimate example of love in the cross. Step two is to appropriate that love for ourselves. You see, the reason we feel the need to look after ourselves before others is because we feel no one else is. All right? We're really good at loving those people who have just been really loving to us, because it's almost as though they've refilled our love tank, if I can call it that. But when people only seem to be taking from us all the time, our tank is, you know, getting depleted. It's running dry. But when we think like this, what we're failing to take into account is that Jesus has shown us infinite love. Or as Psalm 23 says, my cup overflows. All right, you see, God has given us more blessings and more love in Jesus than our tank can actually hold. It's spilling out over the top. Now, I don't need to feel the love from my wife or from those around me, because I have infinite love from Jesus. See, Jesus died for me, Brendan. He died for you, Donna. He died for you, Carol. He died for you, Peter. Understand it. We need to appropriate this love for us and feel that we are loved beyond measure. You see, whenever I think to myself, you know, I'm not feeling very loved right now, I need to look after myself, what I'm actually doing is I'm not living in accordance with what I believe. Because what I believe is I have everything I ever need and more love than I can even hold in Jesus. Friends, that's how we cultivate the spiritual fruit of love. We look to the ultimate example of love in the cross. We've got to look to Jesus. And then we appropriate that love for me. You and I have been shown infinite love by the one person that really matters. I don't need love from anyone else. I have enough to spill over to anyone. Friends, can I encourage you? Look at the cross. If you want to know how to love, look to the cross and feel the love for yourself. And then let that love spill over to others. Or as the Apostle John says, dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. Amen to that. Right. Time for questions. Tamara suggested that all questions should be given in the form of a song. I don't think I'll do that to you. But it is about love. Peter. Yes. 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 Okay, so Pete's question for those at the back, how do you differentiate? Yep. Yep. So the difference between someone's needs and wants. So if someone comes to you and says, I need this, when in actual fact you only think they want it, and you may be running on an hour and a half sleep as an example. Look, it's a good question. What I would say is, it's actually unloving to give people what they don't need. Right? So maybe they'll say, I need this, but what they really need is a job. They don't need handout after handout after handout. They need to learn to go and, like you said, carry their own burden. And the Bible actually says, if a man does not work, he does not eat. Okay? So there are situations where we need to assess whether this actually is a need or it's just a want, and if I give it to them, I'm actually doing them harm rather than good. Right? It's the whole, give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day. Teach a man a fish, he'll never go hungry. So are we going to continue to give him a fish every day? What happens when we're no longer there? They haven't learnt to deal with it themselves. So we need to figure out, you're right, we need to figure out what is a need and what is a want, what is good for them. Okay, what is good for them? I think that's not a bad line to draw. What would be good for this person? So me doing this for them, maybe I'll do it once. All right. So I'll give you an example. A guy rang me up the other day and he's asking for a handout. It happens a lot to ministers. All right, and they've all got their stories. They've all got their stories, and when you push them, the story doesn't pan out usually. This guy, I said, look, I can give you a Coles voucher for $30, but we don't do this regularly. And I made it clear to him that he should not come back to me in the near future because we don't give handouts after handout. We will help someone if that looks like they need it at that point. And I gave him, a Coles voucher that he can only use on food. Right? I didn't give him $50 to go spend on drugs or alcohol. He can only spend it on food. And that was a small token, to give him what looked like was his need. In terms of how exhausted you are, though, depending on, do they really need it? So number one, is it good for them? If it is, then you've got to figure out, well, I've only had an hour and a half sleep. What am I going to do? Again, we look to Jesus. So Jesus didn't say, if I do this, I'm not going to get another hour of sleep. He said, if I do this, I'm going to have infinite punishment poured out on me. So, I've never been a mother who has only been working on an hour and a half sleep because they've had kids up all the night. I have had broken sleep, being a father, but I've never been completely wrecked. So I don't want to, sit there and say it's easy. But when I look at Jesus, I certainly say that what he did wasn't easy. He took infinite punishment for us. He put the needs of others ahead of his own, and that's the kind of love I think I want to show. I want to show Christ's love. And even if it means I'm going to be absolutely zonked tomorrow, I will endeavour to do that. Yeah. Jason. I didn't say never, but go on.
Would you say another action, more popular action, would be to say, what happens if I'm taken down to the Salvation Army, who do work with these people, who do buy money to live? Would you say that?
Absolutely. So what I said to this guy, like, if he continues to come back, what I would actually say to this gentleman is, what you need to do is you need to go to Centrelink and get a caseworker, because they can actually, like, I don't have the skills or the time to actually sit down and figure out exactly what these people need. They're strangers off the street. But sending them to a charity or to Centrelink where they can get a caseworker and say, all right, what is it you actually need? You need to be able to budget, you need to get a job, etc. I think that is an equally loving thing to do. So what I did was I gave him, a small amount of food stamps and advised him that this is not going to be an ongoing thing. He needs to go and seek things like, you know, a charity, help from a charity or help from Centrelink. Second question. So Jason's question is, at Summer Breakout, which is their sort of their beach mission kind of thing up at Cowra, they were asked on the last night not to wear their team T-shirts because it can be a bit intimidating for those coming along. I think it's hard for me to make a judgment call on that without knowing all the details. If it's one person, maybe you've got to weigh it up. If it's a whole bunch of people saying, look, you're a little intimidating, well, let's be less intimidating as Christians. But I think it's hard for me to make a judgment call on that. Sorry, Jason. I need more information. Another question. Yes, up the back. Yep. Okay, so Raylene's question is, and it's an awesome question, how do you love those that are really hard to love? How do you love those that are really hard to love? Now, the thing about love, which this is one of the things that hit the cutting room floor for this sermon, I didn't want to be here all day, is that love is a feeling, but it's more than just a feeling. Right? So we can feel love, but we also do love. So it's a mix of both, and one relates to the other. So what do you do if these people are really just hard for you to find that feeling of love to? What I would say is two things. Number one, I think you start by being loving to them. Okay? Even if you're not feeling it, do things that they really like and appreciate, even if it's hard to do. My suspicion is that the feelings of love will follow after that. But here's the second thing, and I think this is a really good bit of advice that I learned over the holidays, is, like, it's very hard sometimes to be self-sacrificial and always do things that they want and never doing things that you want. But here's the thing. What if your joy in life came from their happiness? What if you could turn your mind around so that your joy in life did not come from your happiness, your joy in life came from their happiness? Because that's how God works. All right? And I'm suspicious. I'm like I suspect that that's actually part of what it means to be made in the image of God. God is happiest when he's giving out love, even to his enemies. Wouldn't it be great if that was us? If my joy in life came from seeing the smiles on other people's faces, well and truly over and above my own joy. That would mean that I would get joy from bringing them joy. And so I think that's another good bit of advice for everyone, whether it be the people you are find it easy to love or those you find it hard to love, okay, is think to yourself, A, what would God do? What would Jesus do? So always look to Jesus, Raylene. Always look to Jesus and say, what did he do? These are the people that were putting nails in his hands and he still loved them. All right, that's the kind of love that God wants us to show. But secondly, think, well, what if I make it my goal in life to find my joy in their happiness? And you go out of your way to be nice and loving and caring and compassionate to them, and they might continue to slap your face, all right? They might. But you can actually still find, you know, if you've got that mindset change, you can actually still find joy in that they're finding joy. That would be, I don't know if I've explained myself well then, but hopefully you'll find something in there, Raylene. Look to Jesus, show love, and hopefully the love will the feelings of love will follow. Eleni. Yes, so Eleni's saying is like, well, she's making a statement. There is a limit to when someone is being abusive. So I'll give you an example. If I find out that a wife is being abused in her household, and abuse comes in many various forms, okay? It can be physical, it can be sexual, it can be psychological, it can even be financial, right? Saying to your wife or husband, here's $40 and that's all you've got for the week, that's abuse. That's a type of control. Right? For a woman or man in that situation, I would advise them to get out. Okay? There is a difference between showing love and putting yourself in harm's way. And in the end, you're actually not being loving to your abusive spouse by allowing them to continue in this sinful behavior. So it's a win-win from various areas. But that doesn't mean you stop showing love to your abusive spouse. You can continue to show them love even when you've taken yourself out of the dangerous and violent and abusive situation. And it's the same with those around you. So, let's just say there's a work colleague that is always, always hurting you. You can actually remove yourself to a certain extent from that situation where they will continue to hurt you, but still show them love. Now, I don't have all the details of how to do that, but if your mindset is, all right, I'm removing myself from the situation of abuse and hurt, but I still need to show that person love whenever and however I can, I think that's the Christian way to go. And again, look to Jesus. These are people that are killing him, and he says, please forgive them, Father. He was praying for those who were persecuting him. Incredible. Another question? They did, yes. Some did. So the 12 stayed in, this 12 stayed in, well, the 11, 12, no, 12 stayed in Jerusalem, but the early church scattered. When persecution arises against you, there's one of two courses of action. One is you can remove yourself from that situation, or two, you can stay there and face the consequences. And both are Christian things to do. The Apostle Paul ran away once, and he later on said, I wish I'd stayed. All right? Both are there, yeah. Dave. So Dave's question is that in certain relationships, some people are inherently more givers and some people are inherently more takers. And is it loving to say to the taker, it'd be nice if you came over to this side, the light side. I think it is loving because what we're doing is we're trying to help them grow in godliness. God is a giver. He continually gives. That's one of the things we continually fail to remember about God, is he will continue to give. And we think to ourselves, oh, I need to hold some back. All right? And so that's where greed comes in. I need some to hold some of what I've got back, whatever it be. It might be money, it might be energy and time, etc. We forget that God continues to fill us up. He continues to give. In telling someone else that they need to be more of a giver, you're actually just encouraging them. Do it in a loving way, not a rebuking way. But you're encouraging them to become more Christ-like. That's a good thing. Just got to do it in a loving way, an other person-centered way. So it's good to do it in, like, here's a self-centered way. You're not giving me enough. The loving way is, it would really benefit you to be more Christ-like in this. Look at Jesus. He gave to anyone and everyone. Yeah. I think we have time for one more question. Nope. Okay. I will hand it back to Dave. Thank you, brother.